And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM at the University of California, Irvine campus. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today is Wednesday, November 27th, 2019. If you'd like to email me, I'd like to hear from you. Email me at penonfire@earthlink.net. Tell me what you think of the show. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Stitcher, and when we upload the shows, they arrive in your podcast file, and there you go. You can listen again and not miss a show. Today, for the entire hour, my guest is Christopher Ketchum. He's been a freelance writer for more than 20 years and has published in Harper's, Counterpunch, National Geographic, Hustler, Penthouse, The New York Times, Pacific Standard, Sierra, Earth Island Journal, Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, on and on and on. He's here primarily today to talk about his new book and also his first book, This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West, published by Viking. Hi, Chris.
Hey.
Great to have you on the show. I have to tell you, there's so much to talk about, but first I have to say I read This Land along with Richard Powers' Overstory, in the last couple of weeks. And I can't think of two books that go together better than these two. One is fiction, obviously, and yours is not, although I wish it were. And your book, This Land, I think it's the most important book I've read this year, perhaps the last few years. I'm knocked out by the writing, by the reporting. And I'd love to hear you talk about how the book came about.
Well, I'd say that the book probably came about in similar fashion as the Overstory came about. I mean, Powers wrote a pay-in and a homage to, the incredible complexity and beauty of forest ecosystems. I was writing, I wrote This Land primarily to defend the complex biodiversity, which itself is beautiful, of the last wildlands of the American West. So we're talking about the hundreds of millions of acres managed on behalf of the American people by the United States Bureau of Land Management, the United States Forest Service, and National Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and other land management agencies. And I wanted to write something that defended those landscapes and the wild flora and fauna that inhabit them against the depredations and follies of industrial capitalism and exploitation.
So when we're talking about the West, especially for people not familiar with the region, we have a lot of listeners overseas. Talk about the region that you're calling the West.
Well, in the book, I define the West as that region which begins west of the 100th meridian, which is basically once you cross the middle of Kansas, you cross the 100th meridian, and after that, rainfall drops to at or below 20 inches a year, or precipitation, rather, both as snow and rain. And so you've entered basically arid lands. You've entered the American desert. And, of course, there are variations within that desert. You have the uplands and the mountains that are more heavily forested, and get a lot more precipitation. But for the most part, we're talking about a steppe. Tree vast grasslands, steppe, canyons, and desert that gets very little precipitation. So the West is the arid country. It is the dry country. It is the country where the vistas open up into these enormous, spectacular, crisp scenes because the air is so dry, because there's so little rain. The West does not really include, as I define it, the coastal California, coastal Oregon, or Washington. It is basically inclusive, rather, of that whole area from east of the Sierra Nevada, east of the Cascade Range in Washington, east of the coastal ranges in Oregon, all the way to basically the I'd say the middle of Kansas. But really, the West, as in terms of public land, is primarily those major public land states. So Utah, Nevada, Wyoming, Eastern Oregon, Montana, sort of, Colorado, sort of. But the major public land states are Utah, Nevada, Idaho. And so that those are the states that I concentrated on. And also, you know, the my interest was sparked by the simple fact that these are this is a vast commons in which we all share ownership. So in a strange way, in the most capitalistic nation on earth, we have evolved a system by happenstance that is socialistic. we're all co-owners of this hundreds of millions of acres of land. And so to celebrate that fact and to defend that land as a commons, I think, is an obligation of all citizens.
Well, even though it's our land, it seems that corporations and big business sort of rule it, right?
Well, what's happened on the Great American Commons of the West, these public lands, is a classic instance of regulatory capture, which is common in interest group politics, is common in democracies, in which you have powerful special interests that are able to wield their money and influence over government so as to capture the very agencies that are supposed to be regulating specific industries. So in the case of the Bureau of Land Management, you know, the joke is that the Bureau of Land Management is really the Bureau of Livestock and Mining. Well, indeed, that's the case. It's not a joke. The BLM is a captive creature of livestock interests, of agriculture and mining interests, and mining inclusive of which includes oil and gas drilling, hard rock mining, so gold, silver, molybdenum, etc. The Forest Service is a captive creature of timber interests. And so what you have is you have these regulatory agencies that are supposed to regulate on behalf of the American people, but really regulate on behalf of these very powerful moneyed interests that want to exploit the land for profit, and for profit on the backs of the citizenry who subsidize these profiteering corporations and interests.
But when we think of these land management agencies, we're led to believe that they are actually protecting the land for the people, right?
Yeah. And it's a lie. The truth is that you will find, well, one of the most interesting things about research in this book is that I met a whole host of folks who currently work inside the BLM and the Forest Service, particularly also the National Park Service, though that is a less corrupted agency, in my opinion, who say that they entered their, you know, they joined the BLM and the Forest Service with good intentions, with advanced degrees in biology, with an ecological mindfulness about protecting land and landscapes, about protecting wild flora and fauna, about preserving the biological and genetic integrity of the other than human creatures that also share this world with us. And what they found was that their higher-ups, the political appointees and the career bureaucrats, did not want them to actually enforce the very laws that they thought they were being hired to enforce. So we're talking about everything from the Wilderness Act to the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts to the National Environmental Policy Act to the Federal Land Policy Management Act to the Endangered Species Act and on and on. And so they suffer a kind of psychic rift in working for these agencies, in which they are riven, they are torn in half. On the one hand, they want to keep their jobs. Maybe they have families, mortgages, need health care, have health problems, whatever it is, and they do not have the capacity to act as heroic whistleblowers or rebels against the system, and so they're trapped. And they can't do the right thing simply because their higher ups refuse to allow them to do so.
What about, well, there's so many things to talk about here, so many things that I wasn't quite aware of, I sort of suspected, but wasn't quite aware of, such as the damage cattle do, the cattle grazing, that how trees are felled so cattle can graze, and
It's not just trees. I mean, we're talking about cattle grazing is the most widespread use of the public lands, both on BLM and Forest Service land. And it is the most destructive use of that land in terms of total acreage affected. It is a force of desertification. It is a force that denudes the land, pollutes the streams and springs and riparian corridors, erodes the soil, brings invasive species. It involves a massive a pest and predator eradication program to make the wildlands quote unquote safe for cattle. So we're talking about the mass slaughter of coyotes, beavers, prairie dogs, whatever species is deemed to be a pest to the livestock industry is destroyed on behalf of that industry. Using tax dollars, using your dollars and my dollars and the dollars of our listeners here. And so what I'm talking about specifically is a program run out of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, out of its sub-branch, the Animal, Plant, and Health Inspection Service. And the program is called Wildlife Services. And how do they service our wildlife? They kill the wildlife. That's their service. So Wildlife Services goes out and conducts aerial gunning campaigns, spreads poisons across the land, distributes cyanide bombs, cyanide landmines all across the land to kill coyotes. And so you have instances where little children, 14-year-old children, such as happened in Idaho in 2017, stumble upon these cyanide landmines and accidentally trip them and are nearly poisoned to their deaths. So yes, you have a massive program of intervention and control on the public lands on behalf of livestock, and that is in addition to the simple fact of livestock overgrazing fragile arid landscapes.
And you talk quite a bit about the bison that are slaughtered. And which I found just so heartbreaking.
So the bison. I mean, the long story about the bison is that the bison populated the Great Plains in numbers exceeding in the tens of millions. They were eradicated in the late 19th century by both market hunters and the United States Army, colluding together to destroy the native, the Plains tribes, the Native Americans that were resisting westward expansion. Because the Plains tribes depended, in particular I'm talking about tribes like fierce and effective combatants like the Sioux, they were totally dependent on bison for survival. So bison provided their clothing, their food, their fuel, etc. So if you got rid of the bison, you would then defang the Plains tribes and then allow Manifest Destiny to finally achieve its great ends. And one of those ends, of course, was connecting the continent, the two halves of the continent together with the Transcontinental Railroad. With the Transcontinental Railroad, you suddenly opened up markets in the east for the transport and distribution of fresh beef from rangeland operators. So after the railroad, so basically after the Civil War, you have the last Indian wars of the plains, last Indian resistance. You have then the destruction of the bison, the replacement of the bison with the cattle industry, and then and you have the beginning of what's called the cattle kingdom, as one historian described it. So today, you know, bison, I mean, by 1900, bison were almost totally exterminated. So there were an estimated 60 million bison in North America upon, you know, the pre-Columbian numbers, that is, were amounted to roughly 60 million. By 1900, there were something like 100 of them left. From 60 million to 100. It's just incredible. This is a destruction of biomass that is unparalleled in modern history. Maybe paralleled by the destruction of the passenger pigeon, but in terms of total biomass, I don't think so. And so these 100 bison were protected and preserved, or were protected and given habitat preserved for them in one place, Yellowstone National Park. So today, fast forward today, those 100 bison that survived the ecocidal expansion of Euro-Americans into the West in the 19th century now number about 5,000. But guess what? The livestock industry that runs cattle all around Yellowstone National Park believe, and this is no basis in science, literally, it's just like a superstition, believe that the bison carry a disease called brucellosis. And that disease is going to be transferred to their cattle running on the open range. Ergo, the National Park Service, serving livestock interests, routinely slaughters the last remaining genetically pure, free-roaming bison that represent one of the greatest heritages, natural heritages of this continent. They slaughter these animals every year because they might roam outside of Yellowstone National Park, and transmit their disease, brucellosis, to open range cattle in the national forest on the BLM land that surrounds Yellowstone National Park. Well, it's just a complete falsehood. It is like I said, no basis in science, and yet this determines policy with regard to these incredibly beautiful animals.
I like your story about camping and waking up with the bison sort of grazing around you.
That was along the Madison River on the west side of Yellowstone National Park, and it was beautiful.
Yeah,
I woke up and unzipped the tent. There was a gigantic bull, like, I don't know, 3 feet from my tent, grazing, just staring at me. Well, he didn't care about me. He cared about the grass. And all around him was a herd of bulls, females, and calves, young calves, who are described, they're tufted like sheep, and they have an orangish tint to their fur. Very beautiful, very lovely. It was an honor to wake up among them.
Yeah. And you say, for every bison killed, let's burn an American flag. And I bring that up because I want to say that I appreciate how your point of view is all over this book. And it's not sort of a subjective look at you know, America and land and what's happening to land, but you're all over it. And I wondered if your editor for this book ever worried about your strident point of view, or did he or she, encourage it.
Right. Well, first of all, I think we should just burn American flags anyways, just as, because the symbol is meaningless. What matters is the actuality of our political life. So let us burn many American flags every day. The line in the book was particular, I mentioned that in the book because, you know, in 2018 or 2017, the Obama administration declared the bison our national mammal, but meanwhile did nothing to actually change the conditions on the ground for our national mammal, to protect it in Yellowstone National Park. which is just par for the course with the hypocrisy of both the Democratic and Republican parties. As regards my editor, no, he was totally hands-off. He's an incredible editor. His name is Paul Slovak at Viking. And he was just like, yeah, man, just go with it. Whatever. Whatever, buddy. It's raw. You know, he was like, yeah, man. Everything is, it was open. It was beautiful because, for the most part, when you deal with magazine editors, as I have throughout most of my career, they're the most censorious, milquetoast, cowardly little creatures you can imagine. They're constantly running from the arms. They're like, oh, my God, my shadow. You know, these are people who just, I don't know, man, magazine editors. They just don't. They don't want voice. They don't want opinion. They want to maintain the pretense of objectivity. And of course, there is no objectivity. Objectivity is a lie produced by the media to create the veneer of authority, right? And that authority then will determine how you think. Well, no, it's almost all of it is opinion, Well, there you go. So I was completely open in my opinions in the book.
And magazines, too, are driven by advertisers. And if advertisers are not happy, then editors are not happy. Yeah?
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not saying that the editors themselves that the editors themselves embrace this paradigm of censorship, of self-censorship, and milquetoast mediocrity, they are forced to do so in order to keep their jobs.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. You know,
and it's kind of pathetic, really. If you get an editor, in a bar and get him or her drunk, then they will talk freely on the subject.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we see our current administration, our current president, doing all sorts of really horrible things as regards the environment. And I was so disheartened to hear that in the previous administration, when Obama was in office, that there were horrible things going on then too. And I don't know. I'm just sort of shaking my head.
Well, capitalism, look, Barbara, capitalism is a nonpartisan affair.
Right.
Okay. Both parties embrace it, and capitalism, by its very nature, involves constant exploitation of the natural world and what capitalism reduces to something called natural resources for the benefit of the one chosen species, God's chosen ones, Homo sapiens, right? So, I mean,
yeah.
You know, Obama is going to serve the capitalist interest just as much as Trump. The difference is that Obama will pretend to care about the environment and thus mollify the easily duped so-called progressive left in this country, who then say, well, we have a black Democrat running the machine of exploitation and rape and corruption, so it's okay. You know, okay. And, you know, it's like, in the book I talk about how, for example, anti-war resistance just disappeared under Obama, yet Obama perpetuated many of the Bush era national security initiatives, programs, whatever you want to call them. Well, what they really were programs of murder and mayhem and destruction overseas. But the left, what did the left do once Obama got in office? Boom, no more anti-war resistance, even though the wars continued and the murders continued and the slaughter continued. Similarly, you know, under Obama, you had a massive expansion of oil and gas drilling on public land. You had destruction of all sorts of endangered species. But it was okay for the environmental left, the progressive left, because it was a Democrat in office doing the raping.
So what, you know, what do voters do? You know,
that kind of stuff makes me sick.
Right.
And it's putrid and disgusting. The hypocrisy of it. The lack of moral character, the moral vacuum that it exposes is horrendous, and is something that when you behold it, and when you just report on it, as I did in my book, it just makes you sick to your stomach.
What do voters do, though? You know, it's like, who do you vote for or do you not vote? I mean, you have to do something. You want to feel like you're doing something in terms of putting in office, you know, the better of the two in the system
the
that we have.
Two evils, right?
Pardon me?
Right?
Yeah.
The lesser of two evils.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know what voters do. I don't think you do anything in a system as corrupted as ours by money, where money is treated as a vote in itself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you do.
Yeah.
I think you go Hong Kong on that situation and start breaking things and start rioting and destroying property and engaging in mass resistance against the system. But listen, you know, we're talking about defending landscapes for the other than human. Are human beings going to rise up to the occasion to defend something that's not directly benefiting them? That is, that, you know, we're talking about all sorts of wild flora and fauna, just grasslands, for example, that have the right to exist. But guess what? That right to exist is going to be tossed aside if our need for more food to feed an expanding population is required. So what are we going to do? We are going to destroy that land in order to feed ourselves. And that's just the long and the short of it. I mean, I don't, you know, and I think this really comes down to how we view ourselves in relation with Mother Earth. Do we see ourselves as humble, dependent creatures who stand before our mother, the earth, with love and respect and honor? Or do we just want to rape our mother? Well, guess what? We just want to rape our mother.
Yeah.
And that's, there you go. I mean, yeah. I can't. I know people, listeners, will be like, this guy sounds like he's crazy. He sounds like a nut job. But I think our system is the nut job. I think our system is crazy. I think raping your mother is crazy.
Well, it's kind of...
listeners like to rape their own mothers, but that's kind of wacky.
It's kind of like what you talk about in the book where, you know, people who are defending trees, defending animals, doing Ed Abbey types of things are called terrorists, when in fact the corporations are the terrorists.
Yes, and they terrorize living things. They kill living things for profit. You know, eco-saboteurs, let's not call them eco-terrorists because they don't terrorize anything but the bottom lines of business. Eco-saboteurs, they're only destroying inanimate objects, machines. Whereas the machines are going out and killing living things to make money. Well, okay. In our twisted, sick world, in a value system that places money above everything else, above life itself, well, we call those people who destroy the machines that are killing living things terrorists. But we don't call those who operate the machines terrorists.
Right.
Well, it's like, I don't know, I guess an open-air madhouse.
Yeah. Well, I should probably at this point say you are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Christopher Ketchum. His book is This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West, published by Viking. And I should also say the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of who you hear speaking here, Chris and me. Talk about the Escalante staircase. That was something that kept coming up throughout the book that we have to talk about.
Well, the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument was established in 1996 by proclamation of the Clinton administration. And it was a 1.9 million acre monument stretching across an enormous wild landscape of plateaus, mesas, canyons, grasslands, steppe. It is as I write the book, my favorite place in the whole damn world. I mean, it's just like, it's one of these, it's like a almost, it's phantasmagorical when you get in deep into that country and wander around amidst the hoodoos and the mesas and the rock formations and the canyons and the incredible seeps and springs that you find deep in lone clefts in the rock. And there's the Escalante River running through it, providing a central riparian corridor where all, you know, animal life depends. And it's a beautiful place, beautiful. And so I was writing about it for the book in terms of the livestock grazing that is ongoing there and that is extremely destructive. So you have parts of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument that are just completely overgrazed, where the native grasses have largely disappeared or are just struggling to survive because they are they're eaten, trampled, and of course in an arid environment, they with the pressure from so many cattle, they die out. Under the Trump administration, the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument was shrunk by presidential proclamation to by half. It was shrunk by half in size and then divided up into three miniature monuments. And I used that act by Trump to illustrate the influence of the Utah caucus in Congress on this administration, on previous administrations as well. So the Utah caucus is, of course, Mormons, almost entirely Mormons. Mormons historically and at present hate the federal government. They hate environmental regulation. They are Christians on steroids. They really believe in total exploitation of the land for the chosen ones, Homo sapiens. And then there's, of course, the chosen ones among the chosen ones, who are the Mormons. They're even more chosen than the Jews. It's incredible. It's a race between the Mormons and the Jews who is more chosen. So the Mormons, Mormon legislators in Congress basically struck a deal with Trump saying, hey, listen, you undo this national monument designation, which was issued under, as I said, Clinton, and was received in Utah at the time in 1996 when Clinton made the declaration as an incredible insult, as an offense to Utahns, to especially Mormon Utahns. And so the Mormon Utah delegation said, hey, listen, we will support you, Mr. Trump, in whatever insane endeavor you want to engage in, right? So they're dealing with the devil here. If you will rescind monument status for the Grand Staircase National Monument and shrink it and open it up to more road building, more development, more recreation, tourism, that is all the things that will make more money. So that's why I wrote about the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument.
Where exactly is it?
It is in south central Utah. Well, I guess southwestern Utah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And if you put your finger on I-15 going south from Salt Lake and mm-hmm. just follow that all the way, say, to St. George, then cut, make an immediate eastward turn, you'll hit the Grand Staircase. It's an enormous, like I said, 1.9 million acre landscape that mm-hmm. is bounded in the north by the Aquarius Plateau and that ends in the south of roughly the Kaibab Plateau.
Okay. You talk in the book about being a vegetarian. Have you always been?
No. No, I've been a meat eater for a long time. Occasionally, I mean, look, if I'm at a friend's house and he puts a plate of meat in front of me, I'm going to eat it just out of respect. So I'm not some nutcase dogmatist about it. But for the most part, yeah, if it's just me, it's like rice and beans.
Yeah.
And why is that so? Well, meat eating is just bad for your health, bad for the planet, produces methane, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's just bad news.
Well, you know, you talk about in the book throughout, you say how we are all implicated. I mean, we drive cars, we take planes, we do all sorts of things. The problems feel unsolvable. They feel too big to me. I mean, you know, what do we do? You know, what do we do, those of us who care about what's going on? What is there to do?
I have no idea. No answer for you. And I say that frankly in the book. I'm open. I say, you know, there's a section where I write, you know, that I'm an investigative reporter. My job is to place demolitions under corrupt structures of public governance and blow them up. That's it. That's my job. I don't know what we're going to do. So I don't have answers for you.
Yeah.
The system marches on inexorably, and there seems to be no end to economic growth and population growth and all the destruction of habitat for the other than human that growth requires. So, you know, right now I'm working on my next book is about birds, right? Mm-hmm. And I've come in just preliminary research, I've come to conclude that the massive die-off of birds occurring across North America since 1970 is the result simply of more people and more economic exploitation of habitat. Oh, you know, birders, if you're listening, you have a choice. Either oppose capitalistic growth, right? Or embrace the mass wipeout of birds in North America. That's your choice. Of course, that's not a choice. That's a choice. It's impossible to make that choice because we're all, as you said, trapped in this system. We're all implicated in it. So I don't know. I don't have answers.
Yeah. We're getting on to the season where we have Christmas trees. We go to Christmas tree lots. And I kept waiting for you to write about Christmas trees. I'm like, what does everybody do? Do we buy fake Christmas trees? Do we use tumbleweeds as Christmas trees? I mean, what do you think? What's going on with all
that? Look, I don't think these consumer choices are really at the heart of the system. I mean, look, you know, people talk about climate change, right? What's the biggest, just to take an example that might seem far afield and tangential, but we will see in a moment how, in fact, relevant this is.
Okay.
People talk about dealing with climate change, right? All right, so the Green New Deal. Is there anything in the Green New Deal that addresses the biggest climate polluter on the planet? And what is that biggest climate polluter? It's the U.S. military. It's the machine of empire and murder and mayhem. Well, is there anything in the Green New Deal about that? Mm-hmm. Do we hear Sanders and Warren talking about dismantling the military-industrial complex? No.
Mm-hmm.
No. Instead, you got a lot of people, putatively of the progressive left, saying, "Well, let's all take shorter showers and stop eating meat."
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you got these gigantic systems in place that are the real source of the problem.
Right.
So, why don't we dismantle the murder industrial complex? Hey, that'd be a good start.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we can't do that because jobs. Oh, we need more jobs building missiles to kill. Children in wedding parties in Yemen,
mm-hmm.
Barbara.
Right.
You see, that's what we got to do. We got to build those missiles to murder little children overseas. And I take this personally because I have little children. I've got a 7-year-old and a 24-year-old daughter. So.
You know, but don't you think people say, you know, let's drive electric cars, let's not eat meat, let's do this and that, because those things are doable, and dismantling the system that is so overwhelmingly out of our reach It's like, what do you do with that? You know, you can take a small step, but how do you do the big steps? I mean, people need to take to the streets. It used to be we had slaves. That changed. There's a number of things, groups of people have changed. But these days, doesn't it seem that we're also sort of apathetic in terms of, or maybe feeling that we have no power to change anything?
We have incredible power to change things. All we need to do is organize around an issue, and one on which we agree on, mm-hmm. on how to transform the system. We could change things overnight. We're not going to do it by driving Priuses and, you know, eating kosher cupcakes or whatever it is. I mean, it's not going to happen.
Right.
The way to change things is an uprising. The problem, of course, is that the uprising would involve substantial sacrifice of comforts. No one wants to do that.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to do that. So, again, I got no answers. I mean, people, that's one of the complaints about my book. Where are the answers? What are the solutions? Oh, the solutions. I'm like, I got no solutions, man.
Well, it's sort of like
I'm not some prognosticator,
right.
And I'm not a visionary. I have no idea. I mean, frankly, here's what I think is going to happen. I think the only change that will ever happen, as history shows us again and again in unsustainable civilizations, is that we will collapse. The system will fall apart. There will be a chaotic reordering of things. And those people best placed to survive that reordering will be those who know how to grow food. So food is the...
Right.
If you want to change things, just start growing your own food.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good start.
Because
you're not going to change. You're not going to change the system. I mean, it's going to implode. Maybe we will change the system. Maybe there's a way to bust up the dominance of elites, because the system is of course set up to benefit a minority across the planet, rich elites. I don't know. I don't have answers.
Yeah, I didn't read the book for answers so much as I think to have my life and my awareness altered, which, you know, it's been so altered. I mean, I was already kind of thinking some of these things, and then you put it into words. And, you know, as I was reading, I was also thinking of you as the writer and how, you know, any writer focusing on a sort of depressing topic for, you know, any length of time, how do you, or how did you kind of, you know, still have a life and not become terribly depressed the entire time you're working on the book?
I drank a lot of whiskey and smoked a lot of cigarettes. I'm not joking. I should put a thank you note in there to the Bullet and Jameson Corporations, you know, for providing me that valuable whiskey. I don't know. Look, it's kind of like Albert Camus' Myth of Sisyphus. Have you ever read
mm-hmm.
The Myth of Sisyphus
by
Albert Camus? All right, he takes the Myth of Sisyphus, which is the story of Sisyphus is that he is punished to roll a rock up a hill for eternity in hell. And once he rolls the rock up a hill, it rolls back down again. Camus, an existentialist, posited that all life is like, that we are all Sisyphus, we are all rolling a rock up a hill. All is futility because in the end we die and there's nothingness afterwards. And yet, we have to embrace the rolling of the rock up the hill, because that is our struggle,
mm-hmm.
even if we know it's futile. So I do my writing, and I in that is my form of protest. as Sisyphus rolling a rock up a hill, knowing it will roll back down again, knowing I might have no effect whatsoever, and yet I must do it.
Right.
I must embrace the rock and embrace the struggle, even though it ends in death and nothingness.
Hmm.
So that's so Camus says Sisyphus, in his own way, is happy because he has embraced the rock. So yes, my happiness is in the embrace of the rock, of the futility of the struggle, and yet the struggle must go on.
Yeah.
You must embrace it and love it. I mean, and there's also, look, in the course of writing that book, I spent just a lot of time wandering across beautiful places, incredible landscapes, wilderness areas, canyons, deserts, steppe, just places still teeming with wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, places that can serve as a redoubt against the metastatic advance of techno-industrial civilization. There are still places out there that we can save. We can save those places. And so earlier, you know, I might have sounded a note of despair or saying that all is hopeless. Well, in terms of the public lands, all is not hopeless. These are places that remain, that can remain free of human domination, that can remain, that can still have their own agency separate from the purposes of Homo sapiens. And so if we are mature as a civilization, we will embrace that and say that yes, there are places on this earth that should be free of us.
Mm-hmm.
That should be free, not free of Homo sapiens, but free of the technology and the ideology that currently grips Homo sapiens like a cancer. Right? This ideology of expansion and growth, of money making, of profiteering, of more and more and more. So I talked myself out of my despair 5 minutes ago, Barbara. I talked myself right out of it.
Well, I like what you said earlier, too, you know, in terms of, you know, if you feel helpless, you need to do something, you know, pick one issue and band together to deal with that issue, you know. I mean, deal with the one issue. I like that.
Well, okay, so for example, there's one issue I think that every American could join in on, and that's the enforcement of the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act is an incredible piece of legislation. It is a radical piece of legislation that, for the life of me, I don't know how the heck Congress passed it. Maybe they obviously didn't read the Endangered Species Act, because the ESA stands directly contrary to capitalist interests. What it says is that if you have a species in a habitat that is threatened with extinction, you can protect, or you could rather, the ESA empowers federal regulators on behalf of the American people to stop all development in that habitat. And if, perchance, that habitat includes a vast array of different biomes stretching, let's say, in the American West from the sagebrush steppe to the timbered slopes of the uplands to the riparian corridors, the rivers, the streams. If a species requires all those different habitats to live out its full life cycle unhindered and unimpeded, the Endangered Species Act empowers us, the American people, to stop all development on that landscape. Okay, my point here being that if the Endangered Species Act was enforced with teeth, as it should be, and currently it is not, and I've got a couple chapters on that in my book, if it was enforced with teeth, we could shut down capitalist industry across the public lands overnight. Boom, gone. Wrong. As Derek's the oil wells, the pump jacks, livestock grazing, timber cutting, road building, fence building, water development, boom, gone. Gone, because there are endangered species out there that require all that landscape unimpeded by human interference. So if you really care about the public lands, as I do, right? Well, listeners, just call up your congressman, congressperson, and say, hey, enforce the Endangered Species Act and bug them about it. Mm-hmm. Bug them and bug them and pester them and be like a gadfly.
What
have we done to enforce the Endangered Species Act? What's happening with the Endangered Species Act? That's one thing that people can do.
I love that. Thank you. Thank you for that. I am so sorry we're at the end of our time.
What?
Yeah, I know. I told you the time
just
would fly
started.
By, right? Maybe when the book comes out in paperback, you can come back on, talk some more.
Oh, that would be great.
And I also want to say that I read the book. I listened to it on Audible, which is a valid way of reading a book. And I have to say, I love that you read it. I love that your emotion comes through, your cynicism, your upset. It was wonderful listening to you read this book. Thank you for that.
Oh, well, you're very welcome.
And
I enjoyed reading it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it was just, yeah, it was perfect. Perfect. Thank you so much for spending the time, for getting up early for you. And
before noon for me on the East Coast.
I know. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Cheers. Bye.
Bye. That was Christopher Ketchum. His book is This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West. I think it's a must read for everybody listening. You can get it on Audible. You can get it here and there if you find it in your library. And I think we all should be reading this book and talking about it. And as he said, if there's one thing you want to do, you want to do at least one thing, call your congressman and bug them to enforce the Endangered Species Act. And there's so much more that we can do, right, if we just do it. In the meantime, get your own writing done. Stay at your desk, whether it's a sitting desk or a standing desk or a desk in a swimming pool, and, stay busy and get your words out there, and have a great holiday. And we'll be here next week with, I believe I have poet Stephen Dunn with me. The first Wednesday in December. Thank you for being with me today.